Good afternoon, and while we're waiting for my talk to load, I just want to say what a privilege and a pleasure it's been to work with this this great group of colleagues and investigators here. They've really helped to advance the REAIM model over, for some of us, I guess it's been a decade. I'm going to wear two hats here. 80%, I'm going to give you a very, very rapid whirlwind tour through the history of REAIM and kind of some little bit of insider stories, as Diane threatened, about why it went certain ways at different points in time. And then my last couple slides are going to be an attempt to start out a more general discussion. I'm going to point out a couple of things about what I saw in each of these, and then we'll invite you to join in. Like the rest of our asocial group of workaholics here, have not only no relationships to declare, but becoming recently a public servant, I now have no income to declare either. So here's the line with the REAIM story. What you can watch in case you fall asleep and want to wake up, across here you're going to see the years of REAIM, how we go, and kind of what phase we're in at the top of the slides. So in the beginning, REAIM was developed largely, as Diane said, out of a lot of frustrations that colleagues and I had. Our first paper came out in late 1999 in AJPH. The other authors on that were Sean Bowles and Tom Vogt. And part of this was the frustration combined of lack of translation, but also our feeling was the important things about making a difference that could take something to scale or tell somebody else how to replicate and implement it were just not reported. They weren't in the methods section anywhere. And it was an effort to broaden the evaluation perspective to give equal emphasis to external validity. A couple of quick insider stories. Originally, Glasgow had the stupid idea to follow the consort type notion, and if you follow that down like Bridget just did, that turns out to be Arium. Fortunately, Tom Vogt said to me, Russ, nobody's ever going to buy that or go with it. So even though it isn't quite correct sequentially, if you think about rolling out a program, we came up with REAIM. I was at Oregon Research Institute then. Initially, it was usually used only by the Oregon group and projects we collaborated on for the first few years. Another kind of interesting inside story that we've come back to after a decade is in our very first publication, we wanted to talk about some summary indices and metrics and things, and in their wisdom, the reviewers struck that out. They said there was no way and that wasn't relevant and that we didn't have any basis to do that on. Give you a little more feel what I mean about why we were frustrated and maybe why we don't see more translation than we do. At the time in the field, and still pretty much today, not quite as dominant, but this model of going from basic research to practice. Do we happen to have another pointer at all or not? This one is like going out. You have one, Joanne? Thank you. Notion here that this is kind of a direct linear process, as you can see, and we go down here. And we might want to come back to this in the discussion. But my hypothesis is that this model is fundamentally broken. It hasn't worked too well for us for the last 40 or 50 years, and we all know the situation we're in now, and so I'm not sure why we keep thinking by doing the same thing that things will get better in the future. So as opposed to this kind of more or less linear model, that thinking that the thing that works best in an efficacy study is going to be what will work best in an effectiveness study, which will translate the best, just a couple of quotes here from a fascinating book by Paul Thomas that I think is kind of interesting about primary care when we think about the era of the primary care, medical home and things, talking about linear thinking versus systems thinking that I at least would like to think is more compatible with the REAIM perspective. Well, after the early years then, we had a bit of an adolescent growth spurt. We had some other colleagues that got interested in it. In particular, as part of an NIH-wide consortium called the Behavior Change Group. We had the investigators listed here that joined our group and started doing quite a bit of work. We also launched our first website. Thank you to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for that. And this was also the first, with a publication there by Lisa Kledges, was our first actual use of REAIM for planning and talking about it, as opposed to after-the-fact evaluation. During this adolescent period, we also expanded to a variety of other research group collaborations. You can see some of the content areas that we were doing there. And we just were starting to get out during that phase into some broader environmental community policy type issues. I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. We did do several reviews of the literature, and we consistently found that, just as I think it was Deanna that was mentioning there, she talked about the worksite, we consistently found this across setting, across target behavior, and pretty much anywhere that you look, those conclusions. And in the words of a English author, Rothwell, I would certainly concur with this, that lack of consideration of external validity is the most frequent, single most frequent criticism that clinicians have of what we call evidence-based medicine today, and that includes RCTs, systematic reviews, and guidelines, is that they're acontextual, and we think somehow, naively, I'm not sure on the basis of what science, that intervention that worked in one setting is, you know, automatically going to be the best intervention for a different setting. Well, our current phrase of REAIM that we arbitrarily cut off and said to 2007 to today, REAIM took another spurt, I think, as a result probably of two things. One, Karen Glanz, Barbara Reimer, and colleagues invited us to write a REAIM chapter, you know, in the Bible that's used in all health behavior, health education classes in schools of public health. Secondly, somewhat due to Larry Green, but just from some other things too, connections, CDC, HRSA, and Robert Wood Johnson got very interested in REAIM and started using it, and in one or two cases requiring REAIM to be used as part of the proposals. We also tried to develop some tools to help people apply the model, thinking at that time the use, and I'll show you one or two, what we call calculators, quizzes, and a self-test to allow people to kind of work through REAIM and some kind of thought exercises. In 2006, we moved the website to the Institute for Health Research, and I'm still grateful that they are continuing to host it today, and it's gone under a couple of important modifications. And I think I'll go on to the next one. As you've seen here today, REAIM has a much broader focus than it did before. I think we've clearly demonstrated that we've gotten away and applied it beyond the individual level. It's been used to evaluate a number of health policies. In particular, Alice Ammerman and her colleagues at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, have been great colleagues. They've used it for their work with state obesity programs, all 50 states working across there. They have a translation center that they not only provide evidence using a REAIM framework about that, but they also have an online training to REAIM, which I'd recommend people that might want to take a look at. And as you heard from Diane and Deanna, to the application to the built environment. You've heard today, we've had a number of things. I'll just hit what you haven't heard about. And then a brief warning, we're almost here. So when we get to the future, you can all wake up and start thinking what questions you have or comments you want to make. But in addition to the things today, there's been work on medication adherence there. You heard about the others. I guess the last one I'll just mention, as part of an NCI-funded project of Centers of Excellence in Cancer Communication Research, REAIM has been used. Here's a little bar chart of number of publications on REAIM over the years, and we're hoping, I don't know if we're going to beat, you can see that's kind of gone up, not quite sure what that function is, if I can fit what math model to it, but we're hoping by the end of the year, we know about several things that we're going to beat last year, which was 28 publications that came to our attention anyway, that primarily used REAIM somehow. So the current website, I won't give you all the history and the sordid saga of how we got there, but I do want to particularly thank Bridget and Barbara McCray, who's in the audience, for their help in revising the website. This is what it currently looks like, www.reaim.org. Thank you. And one of the things that we have featured on there, besides trying to make it a little easier to navigate and to see what's new for frequent users, there's this self-rating quiz that I'll talk a little bit more about, and then other tools, as you can see here. One of the tools that we like to recommend the most is a little graphic calculator. In this case, we've found, as you've heard a couple of speakers talk about, some of the challenges in calculating the denominators and then thinking, well, what do I use to calculate both reach and adoption? And so these are tools, interactive tools, that you can use there. And as you can see on the right-hand side, we have other checklists and tables, suggested measures, some criteria if you want to use ReAIM for a review. Here's the website, and important thing you have to do here as new, Deanna said, friends of ReAIM, is go out on the website so Bridget can look up then next week and see that if we beat this record in terms of the number of visits and uses that we've had. But the website has become increasingly popular over time. And again, we're at a little over a decade and starting to think about where is ReAIM going to go in the future. Here's some thoughts, and we'd love your input and feedback as well. I do think this is going to be the era of CER. I think ReAIM and other approaches to implementation and dissemination have something to contribute. I'm privileged to be working with some new colleagues on public health genomics at NCI. I think regardless of whether we use ReAIM or some other model for dissemination, I think an increasing need is for the focus on transparency. So other people can really understand what we did, even if the truth about how the sausage was made isn't so pretty or whatever, to do that. And there's some possibility with the new PRACES criteria that I don't have time to talk about now, but could if somebody wants to know about this coming out of the consort group with pragmatic trials, that there might be some merging there. So now, switching hat, my last two slides here to get discussion, and those of you that have patiently been hanging in here, thinking back to the other talks that we had, a few thoughts that I have about what our my colleagues had to say is, first of all, Diane, I want to emphasize the multi-level nature of ReAIM, and I think that maybe is one of its contributions. Along with that, with the five dimensions, is the notion of how to combine dimensions, which admittedly we don't have totally worked out. We have a couple different thoughts. Representativeness is key, and also it didn't come across strongly, but the need for cost in this era is an important part of it. Joanne's talk, I think, was right on, demonstrated some issues in denominators, particularly with policy applications, and I thought did a great job of showing the importance of looking for unintended consequences as well as your primary outcome in ReAIM. Deanna's talk mentioned many of the challenges, I think, when we're looking at evaluation issues there, and again, strongly emphasized how ReAIM can be used both for planning and for ongoing quality improvement, too. Finally, Bridget's talk, I thought, did a really nice job of what I was talking about in terms of transparency, including showing you some of the warts that we had and the challenges that we had there, and the importance of contextual factors. And since we didn't illustrate it today, the last thing I wanted to say, because I figured to get it in somewhere, is increasingly we've been using qualitative approaches and information and mixed methods for ReAIM too. So I do want to emphasize that. ReAIM is not just a little formula that you plug, but I think to particularly understand the context, which is important. We're focusing more on integrating mixed methods approaches. Thank you very much.
So we have quite a bit of time for questions. I'm going to leave this last slide up because that's key to the recording. And you all know that the sessions are being recorded, and I believe they'll be accessible through Essential Learning if you subscribe to that. So this slide is going to stay on the screen as a way to keep the tape recorder running. if you'd like to make any questions, comments, if you want to address anybody specifically, it would be great if you identify yourself just by name and where you're from and let it go. Yes, sir.
Yes, I have one question to pick up a little bit on what you just mentioned last. My name is Norman Wagner. I work at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Currently, we're trying to start out and submitted grant proposals for two projects using the REAIM framework, the one in Indonesia and one in India, actually. And both use kind of mixed study design, including qualitative research, because we want to kind of shed a light a little bit more on the motivations and on the barriers so we can include a strong qualitative part. Usually this kind of qualitative part is not really shown in the publications. REAIM from the outside, I've never really worked with it, that's really my first start, kind of looks a little bit, kind of leans towards the quantitative side. And I was wondering if you guys who work with it much more, have more experience, I know how to put it in and to discuss it together, but is there any systematic way you would deal with that, or how do you deal with that usually? Because at one point, barriers are about motivation, attitudes, values, etc., and that kind of does not show in the publications really.
Good question. Let me just start off here. Could everybody hear that okay in here? I'd prefer not to repeat it, but if you can't hear, we'll do it. And I'm just going to, don't worry here, nothing bad's going to happen. Since we're going to have a slide up, I thought we'd use this one, might be more fun to talk about. I'll start answering, and then I'd love the others, who frankly are stronger in qualitative measures and issues than I am, to answer that. One way I think that we've done, starting with the planning and helping people to anticipate barriers, is to have people estimate just what they really think they're going to get in terms of each of these on the basis of just what they know and the literature and their own experience, and maybe talk with their community partners and things, and then to talk about, well, what are the barriers? So let's say you think you can get 50% reach, is just qualitatively to start talking to understand, well, what would it take, you know, to get you to 70% and that sort of thing, and what are the barriers there? With that, let me see about other questions or comments colleagues have.
I just want to be clear that I understood your question. So you were asking about how qualitative and quantitative fits within the framework, or if
well,
you could. Yeah, and I think some of that might be the nature of the types of studies that you've seen published. The way Deanna was describing, the way we're using it now with a more community-based participatory project that doesn't have much publication, we need to get those publications out. It's really, thanks for the reminder. It's really a lot of qualitative information, and so they are giving us very rich descriptions using the framework on how things are being adapted, what some of the barriers were, what some of the stories were, and a lot of that is captured and used on the websites. For example, LiveWell Colorado captures stories, and so they're used in popular media where, you know, we might get a some PR or news type stories regarding what's happening in these communities, and those stories could certainly fit into how it's being implemented and how it's being adopted, et cetera. But not necessarily published in the sort of journals that you're probably looking at. Those tend to be more the traditional randomized controlled trials. So, you know, I think you're right. That's a great need and a gap that we should be doing more in getting that out there. Thanks.
Yeah, I think part of it is there's a certain bias in the peer-reviewed journal world towards quantitative studies. So it isn't so much that the work isn't being done, it's harder to get it to press. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yes, sir. Yes. You.
Yes. Dr. Glasgow.
Yes, Dr. Issa.
Have you given thought, when we talk about reach, we usually think about the participants, the target audience, but has been some thought, because it certainly goes into maintenance and adoption, including the interventionist is kind of a measure of reach for the health system.
Do everybody hear that? We generally have been looking, not that there's any right or wrong. I think it's an important issue, and quite honestly, I'm not sure if it really matters which one of the letters, the acronym it lives under. Thus far, we've been treating it under adoption and thinking about a multi-level sense of adoption. And you could go ad infinitum, but usually we would talk about like the community setting in adoption, particularly in something like LiveWell. Then you drill down to like the organizational setting, say if it's a work site or a healthcare or a school-based intervention. And then you usually get down another level to something like the team or the practice. And then finally, the actual agent, him or herself or whatever, the staff members that are there. So we see it kind of under adoption, and under each of those, I think it's an important question, not only about the percentage of people at each of those levels, community, organizations, and settings. And again, the literature tells us very consistently this notion, particularly the representativeness at this adoption and setting and contextual level, is one of the things that's hardly ever reported, that at cost. But I think we need more research on that in terms of those implementation agents. Again, as we're in the era of CER now, I think real important questions, like for a public health community, is can the same intervention be done, let's talk about like a patient navigator, by a peer, a lay leader, a volunteer, as can be a very expensive nurse, patient navigator or not. So I think the study of that in a number of our projects, I think Bridget didn't mention it today, but we actually do contrast or we cross the staff members that have different levels of skills and training and things with the intervention to see if that makes a difference, if that's one of the factors that might moderate an outcome or not. It certainly would impact cost. Does that answer it, Diego?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm Beth from Rush. So I know that the spirit of this is to sort of shift the focus from PDP to their effectiveness, but if the intervention is not effective,
first of all, I don't want this to be a soliloquy, so let me pause, and if somebody else wants to jump in first, I'll jump in sooner or later, but can answer. We do get that a lot, and I think it requires a different type of thinking. But my honest answer is no, the others probably aren't important. At the same time, though, I would say if your reach is 0.01%, I'd say it's equally irrelevant. If it's not something that can be implemented by anybody in the real world because it costs 20 times what the resources anybody has and it requires staff members that don't exist anywhere in a real world setting, I'd argue it's equally unlikely to do that. And what we're trying to do is not to dump on even, what I like to sometimes call pejoratively drug efficacy trial research, but it's to say these other things are important too. And if you or others have seen me do the usual little drill that takes too long to do today about if we had a magic diet pill and think about all the steps that go down there. The point of that, when you start working through, even if you have 50% adoption, 50% reach, 50% implementation, 50% actually, the overall numbers get down there pretty small. The good news in that is, I think, that there's tremendous opportunity at all these other stages because we've invested at least 98% of our effort, our money, our time, our creativity in increasing effectiveness. We've devoted almost nothing to addressing those other factors. Anybody else?
Well, I don't know, actually, look, I mean, for my continued
I think that is a good point. And so many things, I think what I was talking about, I was trying to be polite, in talking about transparency is so many settings, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, I'm just saying be honest about it, is we pick, hand-pick the settings that we study, whether that's a medical office or worksite, we pick our friends. We pick the ones that have the best electronic record. We pick the ones that have the best staff. We pick the ones that we know are the most solid, don't have huge staff turnover, and that sort of thing. So, and again, there's nothing bad, particularly when you're starting out, but the problem with it that I see is then when you claim that this is done in a very small, highly selected set of settings and conditions, and then you claim broad generalization without testing it. That's the problem, and I think that's a huge part of the issue why we don't see greater dissemination and uptake. Unless somebody else has something else, Diego, I'm going to ask you to comment just a little bit on, I thought after the first question here about the qualitative aspects and how we can use that in meaning. If you want to just say a little bit about the link-based 2 study and what we're working on now, an analysis in a project that's largely qualitative that we call the linkage aspect, looking at how we linked back electronic internet-based program to primary care and some of the challenges we had there.
So. Sure, I'll briefly introduce myself.
Actually, why don't you come on up?
Really?
Long as you can. Yeah, come on up.
Come on down. Hey,
people will hear you better and everything.
Well, obviously, we're colleagues. We've worked together. Diego Sunam with Kaiser Permanente here also do some work with Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. And one of the things we're working on right now is describing the connection between a study that originated in a research unit and how that links with the usual care, the operations of a primary care setting within Kaiser Permanente. And we're looking at kind of different domains. One, the patient's experiences around patient satisfaction and how they saw that that intervention either foster kind of greater cooperation with their primary care physician and staff or hinder the integrated care. We're also looking at it from the perspective of the interventionists and the study staff, what are the challenges that they saw in implementing this and going through a large healthcare system, and also looking at from the perceptions of the physicians. Did it complement their care? Did it hinder the care? Did it add more work to their day? So that really goes to that implementation piece. We're looking at it as a mixed methods type of paper with some qualitative data as well as some quantitative data, including chart reviews. So pretty robust, looking at it really from kind of 360 degrees, which is, I think, what REAIM is. It's a 360 degree look at an intervention. And I had a question as well to Joanne. I'm sorry I missed, I was at a different talk, but I missed your piece about unintended consequences, because I think we focus on effectiveness, but oftentimes we don't think about harm. And can you expand a little more on that?
Not only the 360, but 370 degree. The unintended consequences, what I looked at was the vaccine policy in Colorado, it has a relatively easy opt-out exemption from vaccination. And then that causes risk within the population health. So that was one of the unintended consequences that I focused on today.
Another example, I think, because often in public health, and particularly in trying to change health behaviors and prevention, we don't think about it. And frankly, the potential iatrogenic consequences are usually much less serious. I mean, we aren't going to kill anybody, like with the drug overuse or a wrong combination. But I think in prevention, the real risk for unanticipated consequences is by focusing a great deal of energy and attention and time, let's say on smoking cessation, you may focus less time on physical activity or healthy eating or something. Similarly with screening, if a huge effort is put out
to do cancer screening of one type of cancer, either rates of other types of cancers or, say, cardiovascular or diabetes screening, could go down. I'm not saying they do, and I think but what we need to look for are both positive and negative unintended consequences of interventions.
Okay, do we have a final comment? Yes.
Hello, Dr. Dustin.
So Candace's, almost Dr. Nelson's question,
yeah.
So close, was where does a social networking type model work?
Yeah, for the really highly contextual, the lay of the land analysis in the community. Not the intervention.
I could see it working at multiple levels of the model, and others might have different thoughts about this, but as I was picturing, because this the idea of REAIM is very holistic, and I think others have said that, and so you're looking at populations within a context accessing information or an intervention that could be offered in a variety of settings, and so I could see where a social network type approach to looking at reach, how does something spread amongst sort of that diffusion of the innovation, but also at the adoption level, I think we talked a little bit about social norms and who reinforces the intervention. Is it being done by, for example, if it's a smoking policy, by the police, by the owner of whatever the restaurant is that's maybe trying to enforce it, or by the patrons themselves. And so I think it's kind of hard to say, that approach would fit in the R or in the A, but I could see it being used in either way because most of this stuff is it's either going to spread through the population you want to impact, or it's going to spread through the delivery system. And so that would be very interesting, I think, to apply it that way. Are we done?
Somebody wants to make a
follow-up comment on that?
Well, I just think it would help to inform what you look at, what you see in terms of the E, I, and M as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and with that, this session is over. Again, I want to thank you all for staying to the bitter end. Let's call it the delightful and sweet end of this conference. And I hope to see all of you next year. I think we're in Washington, D.C., if I remember correctly. Thank you.